Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, covering topics of interest to lawyers handling civil appellate matters in Texas courts. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the Texas appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Jody Sanders.
And I'm Todd Smith.
And our guest today is Amanda Taylor from Butler Snow in Austin. She's an appellate lawyer there. And if you have seen any CLE presentations on the TCPA, the anti-SLAPP statute in Texas, you've probably heard Amanda speaking about it. She's kind of one of the experts on that statute. That's one of the things we're going to talk to her today. So welcome, Amanda. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Well, thanks. For those people that don't know you, can you just kind of give us a little bit of your background and how you got into law?
Sure. I have been in Austin practicing law since 2003. I went to Baylor Law School and really had my sights set on Austin as the only place that I wanted to practice. It was kind of a weird time, not quite like the pandemic we're in now, but I had big notions of being a trial lawyer, actually, and was graduating law school right when House Bill 4 was passed, which was the court reform bill back in the day. And for my job offer was to go be a plaintiff's trial lawyer, and that was put on hold due to the passage of House Bill 4. So I ended up taking a job at the Court of Appeals at the Third Court, which shaped the trajectory of my career in a way that I never had anticipated, but I'm so thankful for. So I spent a few years at the Court of Appeals and then went into private practice at a small firm, boutique litigation firm, where I was really the only lawyer that knew anything about appeals. And I was quickly given the opportunity to start handling the appeals as lead counsel, even as a young associate. And I jumped on that opportunity and I think had handled about 40 in my first, you know, just few years of practice as a young associate and built my practice from there.
Great experience. So did you do a staff attorney job at the Court of Appeals for your first few years?
I did. I started as a one-year law clerk. That was back when the Court of Appeals used to have first-year law clerks. They don't really do that anymore. In fact, I think I might have been the last class of first-year baby lawyer law clerks because many of my friends that I started with as a clerk are still there as staff attorneys. The court shifted to having permanent staff attorneys due to budget constraints, and those lawyers have so many years of experience, they're invaluable to the court. But I did 1 year as a law clerk and then stayed on for 2 more years as a staff attorney to then Chief Justice Ken Law.
Mm-hmm. That's great experience. We've talked about that a number of times on the show, but in addition to getting that 1 year term and kind of, I'm sure that that kind of gave you a broad overview of what appellate practice was really all about, especially appellate judging, seeing, you know, the insider's view of the court.
Absolutely. Well, and before that, actually, I worked for Bonnie Sutterith, who is now the Chief Justice of the Second Court of Appeals. Mm-hmm. I had the opportunity to work with her when she was on the district bench. And she told me that, you know, law school tries to teach you to think like a lawyer, but the best lawyers will learn to think like a judge. And Chief Justice Sutterith was absolutely correct about that. It's some of the best advice I've ever had in my career.
That is great advice. And then that the extra 2 years of time being on the court as a staff attorney, I mean, that, gosh, talk about a place to hone your writing skills and really learn how to separate the wheat from the chaff, you know, in terms of arguments. That had to be a great experience.
It was, well, you learn that a snarky tone is not going to take you very far.
Mm-hmm. You know, I worked for a state district judge for a couple of years in law school. And the thing that surprised me, I think, as a young, even a law student when I was doing it, is you start to see the work product that comes into the court. And it's really surprising because in law school, you know, you think, oh gosh, everybody that's gotten out and passed the bar must be really good and really effective. And then you start to see the things that get filed and realize, I think I can actually do this after all.
It does give you a little confidence boost.
That's right. I'm sure. Well, so you mentioned sort of your early career practice, or strike that. You mentioned your early jobs in your career, but tell us about where you are now and what you're doing there at Butler Snow.
So yes, I am at Butler Snow. I changed firms. I was with Beck Redden, excellent firm, lots of friends there based out of Houston. And I moved over to Butler Snow about 2 years ago, really with the appeal, to use a pun. The appeal to me was the opportunity to expand my practice beyond Texas. Butler Snow is based out of Jackson, Mississippi, or Ridgeland, Mississippi. We have about 400 lawyers, primarily through the Southeast, but also in other states in New York and the Southwest, and even Singapore. So it was an opportunity to grow my practice beyond Texas, and that was very exciting to me. And I've actually been named by the firm as the practice group leader for our appellate practice group.
Congratulations.
That's awesome.
Thank you. So that is something that will be rolling out, breaking news, that will be rolling out pretty soon here. I'm very excited to lead that new practice group for the firm. We previously had an appellate and written advocacy group that we then folded back into commercial litigation. And now we are going to put our emphasis back on a standalone appellate practice. And we get to build that out of Austin and through the Southeast.
That's awesome. Well, congrats. That's great news.
Thank you.
Westlaw Edge is the standard for legal research, bringing together a legacy of quality and accurate legal research and the latest advancements in technology. First of its kind features like the next generation of legal search, intelligent document analysis, integrated litigation analytics, and the most powerful citator expedite research tasks that were once incredibly complex and time consuming. Westlaw Edge allows attorneys to deliver the fastest answers and gain the most valuable insights, providing a clear strategic advantage. Be a better attorney, make your firm better, and serve your clients better than you have before with Westlaw Edge.
What does moving your practice beyond Texas look like for a board-certified Texas civil appellate lawyer?
At Butler Snow, we do things a little bit differently than at most firms because we are based on practice groups, as I just mentioned. And so it's not necessarily a jurisdictional division between cases. So I've now had the opportunity, if there is a case, an insurance matter, for example, that's going on in one of our other states, but they need a law lawyer. And that's what we all do is we come in on issues of law and procedure and jurisdiction. I can apply those skills to any jurisdiction, just as I'm sure the two of you have done in other states, and it's not confined to Texas. And so I actually had the opportunity earlier this year to go argue a case in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which I don't think I would have had not having been at Butler Snow, but that was a great opportunity. And there are other cases where I'm working with lawyers in New Orleans or working with lawyers in Mississippi or Tennessee. And I have the opportunity now to start understanding what appellate practice looks like in some of those other states. Texas has such a sophisticated appellate bar. It's really a model for other states to follow. I know recently you had Kevin DeBose on the podcast who was talking about our standards of appellate practice, and Texas is the only state that has those. I'd like to see us advance the ball in other states to look more like Texas on the appellate front.
It really is interesting. I've done some work in other states too, and just the rules that do or don't exist in other states and the differences. I mean, we really have a very comprehensive framework here that I think a lot of states don't have. I mean, due in part to just the size and the number of appellate courts we have.
You know, I've started to really think about why Texas has a different form of appellate practice. And there are a number of things, but I think the way our interlocutory appeals statute is structured under CPRC 51.014. In fact, where the TCPA finds its basis for an interlocutory appeal that we're going to talk about today. But I think the vast numbers of interlocutory appeals that we have in Texas, because our legislature has made that choice, provides so much more opportunity for people to handle appeals. And I think that that by statute is different than other states. And I actually did a statistical analysis of interlocutory appeals in Texas a few years ago, and the numbers are just overwhelming because, you know, you just look at 51.014 and you see appeals about all kinds of things, but mostly pleas to the jurisdiction in certain cases. The TCPA obviously is huge. We have another statute that allows for interlocutory appeals of arbitration, motions to compel arbitration if denied. And those things impact our appellate dockets and therefore create opportunity for appellate lawyers.
Mm-hmm. And having one high court that's devoted to civil only, I think makes a difference too, because it seems like in a lot of states, when you're fighting for review at a high court with discretionary review, I mean, so often there's so many criminal issues that take precedence over that. And here we don't, you know, I mean, it is a limited jurisdiction court, but they still, every case they take has a civil component to it.
Right.
We sometimes forget just how good we have it.
We do.
Lawyers. I mean, when I tell people from out of state that we have 14 intermediate appellate courts, they just, their minds get blown. There are plenty of states that just have one.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Right.
So we are really fortunate, and the legislature has done us appellate lawyers a favor by, you know, enacting and continuing to amend and add to Section 51.014. And then with that and the sort of expansion of mandamus practice, you know, it's definitely that being a Texas civil appellate lawyer is a niche that's worth filling and very fulfilling on top of that. But it's interesting, you know, what you say about the skills sort of translating out into other jurisdictions. I think that's, I'm sure that's true. I just tend to get sort of confined in my little Texas niche.
Don't get me wrong. I still love Texas.
Well, that's great. So we do want to talk to you about reappeals, but more specifically, we want to, as Jody suggested when we were opening the show, we want to talk with you about the Texas Citizens Participation Act, which, if anyone is listening to this and you don't know what that is, that you're in for an education. But most folks, I think, who are going to fall within our audience are going to know what the TCPA is.
I've heard it called the Appellate Lawyer Full Employment Act. So I feel like that checks out for the last few years.
I think that's true. But my other nickname for it is stealth tort reform. But, but I've handled TCPA cases. I'm familiar with the statute, but my level of knowledge doesn't approach yours, Amanda. I mean, you've spent a lot of time over the last several years becoming really, you know, one of a handful of people that just come to mind off the top of my head for folks who do this on a regular basis. So tell us, how did you get to be so embedded in TCPA work?
Well, it was inadvertent. I was asked to give a CLE presentation at the Appellate 101 course that we used to have in person every September and is now coming up on Zoom. It's a great conference where all of us appellate lawyers across the state like to come together, and especially for the younger lawyers, the 101 course is a great introduction to start building that appellate network. And I was asked to give a presentation on interlocutory appeals generally, not limited to the TCPA. This was back when TCPA jurisprudence was still just developing. The statute had been passed originally in 2011, amended to expand for interlocutory appeals in 2013. And this was shortly after that. So I was still telling lawyers what this statute was. Many had never even heard of it at that time. And as I was preparing to give that presentation, although it was supposed to, and it did cover all types of interlocutory appeals, I saw the writing on the wall that the TCPA was about to have a huge impact on Texas litigation because of the plain language of the statute. And the Supreme Court quickly picked up on how broad that plain text was. It allows for a motion to dismiss of certain types of legal actions, but especially as it was drafted back then, that was a pretty all-encompassing standard. And so Bob Pemberton said, as a justice on the Third Court of Appeals, it is a game changer. And there's really no better quote for the TCPA than that.
Oh, I like the quote where he said, if a certain justice on the Court of Appeals woke up one morning and decided that something related to, you know, something to that, then, you know, he would probably be right or something. That's a big paraphrase. But I know you know the opinion I'm talking about, Amanda.
I do.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, it certainly has been a game changer. In fact, I was telling Jody when we were talking about this episode coming up that, you know, I got approached about a TCPA case probably in 2013 or 14. And when the statute was still pretty new, it was about an appeal. And I looked at it and thought, I don't want to touch this. This is terrible. this is a complete loser. Look at this statutory language. And it's taken all this time of folks litigating the granting of these motions to dismiss to kind of clarify that, yeah, the statute, you know, it didn't take that long for the Supreme Court even to say it really means what it says. And you're not going to like the scope of the way that we interpret this. But yet it seems like over time, and certainly we'll get to the recent amendment of the statute, but it seems like over time that the appellate courts have kind of sort of the pendulum started to swing back the other way, particularly since we've had a big change in the makeup of our courts, some of our major metropolitan courts in the last election cycle.
Absolutely. The pendulum really started to swing at the very end of 2018. A few opinions came out of our more urban courts in Houston and Dallas, I think one or two out of Fort Worth also, that began to pull back on the breadth of the TCPA. But really, it was 2019 that we saw an absolute flip of movements winning on appeal versus movements losing on appeal. I mean, statistically, the numbers, they simply reversed from 2018 to 2019. And now that shift has continued into the first half of 2020. It's a remarkable change. And there, I've identified, I think, four reasons for that change, one of which was the election. And I'm happy to talk about each of those if you're interested. But the election in 2018, what we saw was 26 new Democratic intermediate appellate judges, big D Democrat judges. 19 of those replaced Republican incumbents. But I don't think it is the fact that they were blue. I think it's the fact that they were new. I think regardless of party, the fact that you just had new blood on the court opened them up to being, you know, willing to adopt a revised interpretation, opened judges up to hearing arguments from non-movements against the breadth of the statute that perhaps their incumbent predecessors were just more willing to say, you know, the Supreme Court has said we've got to give the plain text its ordinary meaning. It's very, very broad. Our hands are tied. And I think when you got such a big crop of new justices, they were more willing to break from that pattern.
My personal experience, I think, supports that, because even in Fort Worth and Eastland, where you have all Republican judges, they still started to rein in the scope right around that same time. And it was some of the newer justices that were writing those opinions. So I think regardless of party, I think you're right. They just were more willing to listen to, and maybe even just having seen what had happened over the last few years with the broad expansion of the scope.
Right. Absolutely. The volume of opinions is another reason, I think, for the shift, because you went the first year of enactment, the first year that there were opinions, there were only two. That's it. In 2020, we already have 110 opinions as of August 12th. So we're looking at over 200 opinions. We're talking about the difference of 2012 to 2020. Think about what that means for the appellate justices and their dockets. How many appeals are clogging their dockets, taking their time? I think they finally said enough is enough and realized that unless the interpretation was narrowed, it was just going every single case was going to have a TCPA motion, and it adds time and expense to civil matters. So you
overlay within that same time frame the legislative amendments to the statute, which scale it back somewhat in terms of application. Some would say that they didn't go far enough, but the Bob Pemberton, you know, relate to language has been scaled way back. In fact, that phrase was struck from the statute, if I remember correctly.
Correct. That's right.
You know, just existing in the same room as something, you know, no longer is necessarily sufficient to trigger the TCPA. And I don't want to jump too far ahead, because I want to come back to the other reasons that you've observed for the pendulum swinging. But are we seeing any opinions coming out now under the new statute?
This is very exciting, Todd. Just as of yesterday, we got the first opinion under the new text. Well, there was one. I'm always one day behind because it takes Westlaw a day to get them out to me. But in the last 2 days, we've now had two opinions under the new text. In just odd coincidence, they're almost exactly the same issue. They both presented declaratory judgment claims. which is now, under the 2019 version, expressly considered a legal action, meaning it's subject to dismissal under the TCPA. And in both cases, the movant argued that the declaratory judgment claim implicated its right to petition, meaning the case should be dismissed. And in both cases, the courts of appeals said, no, it is a legal action. It's a declaratory judgment action, but it does not implicate your right to petition. So you have not satisfied your step one burden, and the claim goes on. Almost exactly the same issue in two cases under the new text, but.
Well, good. And that, I know that was kind of an unsettled issue before. And I know there was some law out of the Third Court of Appeals on that in a different direction than one might have thought. But it's kind of nice that, you know, there's a ton of DEC actions filed in the state. It's kind of nice that we've got some early opinions out there that hopefully will offer people some clarity. And we'll see if those take hold or if some of the other appellate districts go a different direction.
Which courts were those from?
It was San Antonio and Houston First Court of Appeals.
Okay.
Awesome.
Good to know.
So before we move on, I do want to come back and hit at least the highlights of the four reasons you said for the pendulum swinging back. And of course, the election was one. Walk us through the others.
Well, the volume of opinions and the election. And then you mentioned the 2019 amendment. So the effective date of those amendments was not until September 1 of 2019. But the legislature lit the path, right? As of May, we knew what changes had been made. The appellate justices knew the changes that had been made. And I think it allowed them, again, remember, you've got this largely new crop of appellate justices. Mm-hmm. The legislature has already told us that we are intending to pull this back. And some courts have interpreted the amendments as instructive about the original intent under the prior language. And so they've used the amendments even prior to the effective date to say, well, the legislature clarified what it meant originally. So it really cannot be overlooked, even though we haven't had a lot of appellate opinions decided under the amended text. Those amendments very much have shaped the interpretations from May 2019 on. So that's reason number three. And reason number four is the Texas Supreme Court's opinion in Creative Oil versus Lona Hills. That came down December 2019. It has been cited so many times. I can't remember, probably 80 times since December of 2019. In that case, the Texas Supreme Court really did a pivot in its interpretation of the free speech component of the TCPA and what it means to be related to a matter of public concern. The Texas Supreme Court said that a business dispute between two parties that affects only their own pecuniary interest does not, under any sense of the word, have a broader impact on an issue of public concern. And so breaches of contract between two parties that don't otherwise implicate the public or a publicly debated issue in society is just not going to satisfy free speech. That shifted what so many courts had previously been holding under the plain text interpreted by the Texas Supreme Court in some prior opinions, primarily the ExxonMobil versus Coleman opinion, which was an employment dispute. And the communications in the employee file about the employee's performance at work were deemed to satisfy the public concern component because it was in the oil and gas industry. Many courts of appeals took that and ran with it on a very broad basis up until the Supreme Court issued Creative Oil. Although they did not overrule Coleman and some of their other prior broad interpretations, the court did distinguish those cases. And the courts of appeals have since cited Lona Hills as a shorthand reference to this is a business dispute. It's not getting dismissed under the TCPA. That's been a huge change.
Well, and you've got that gap between the time the amendment was announced and the time it went into effect. And as you point out, the amendment coloring arguably at least a statutory interpretation argument. And then you've got the issue of we're not going to fool around with these things anymore. I mean, it seems like the courts of appeals, I mean, they were just getting beaten down with, and still are, I suppose, beaten down with these cases. And it's like, look, stop bringing this nonsense to me that, you know, somebody's private conversation in a business context can be a matter of public concern.
Mm-hmm. to me, that Exxon case kind of showed just how crazy the statute was. Because you think about anti-SLAPP, and like the whole idea is you've got some blogger who's getting money whipped by some big company to, you know, basically kill whatever free speech they've got online. And then now you've got a case where Exxon is the one who's saying that they're aggrieved and their free speech is being stifled. And you just think, wow, what a 180 degree turn under this statute.
To the extent that some people thought at the time of enactment that this was a David and Goliath scenario, that is not the statute that our Texas legislature actually enacted. Texas has the broadest anti-SLAPP statute of, I think it's 26 states that have similar statutes. Texas is the broadest, and then Oklahoma adopted our same language. So I guess we're, Texas always wants to beat Oklahoma. I guess we have the same breadth, but we were first.
Do they adopt the old language or the new language?
They adopted the old language. It was, I think, 3 or 4 years ago that Oklahoma adopted that.
That's very interesting.
When the stakes are high, decisions must be made quickly, and Court Surety Bond Agency is here to help. As the nation's leading surety agency specializing in supersedious bonds, CSBA can handle any size bond ranging from a small temporary injunction bond to a billion-dollar appeal bond. If your client needs protection against judgment enforcement, contact CSBA or visit courtsurety.com today.
Well, you mentioned too, Amanda, statistics. And so are you going and looking at OCA data to determine the numbers that are coming out of the 14 courts? Or we've had Kent Rutter on the show to talk about, you know, reasons for reversal and the major statistical exercise that Haynes and Boone is constantly going through. Are you doing something like that geared specifically to the TCPA?
Yes. The OCA does not publish this data. This is a result of me reading every single TCPA opinion that comes down from our courts. As I mentioned, so far in 2020, that's 110 opinions. And I read them and I analyze them into categories based on the outcomes. And then I provide those statistics to the members of our bar as a learning tool, because I think it's important. And I think it's important for the courts to understand the impact on the dockets and for budgeting. And I find it fascinating, honestly. So I spend a lot of time reading and analyzing TCPA opinions, and it helps me and my clients in my practice because I am up to speed on what's happening under the statute at all times.
Give a little plug for your, what's now, as we're recording this, the upcoming advanced appellate presentation and paper, in which you do lay out some of the statistics that you're talking about. So for the folks that, who are listening who aren't attending the seminar, you can go back and watch it later and get all the materials, and Amanda's paper with the stats and all her observations will be included in that. And by the time this show airs, that's usually the first, it's like right after Labor Day, right? So I guess we've held true to that schedule in the pandemic, even though it's remote, the timing's still the same. So I would imagine that by the time this actually goes live, you will have given that presentation. But certainly I'd encourage anybody to get that and look at it, because it's immensely helpful. And we'll make Amanda's paper available through a link in the website as well.
Well, thank you.
You were mentioning the stats that you've been tracking. So what are you seeing? You kind of hinted at it earlier, but what have you seen in the last couple of years versus the earlier years with the stats?
Right. So I mentioned that there had been a complete flip from 2018 into 2019. There are two, I mean, just taking a 1,000-foot view of categorically, do movements win following an appeal or do they lose? In 2018, movements were winning on appeal, meaning the Court of Appeals said, yes, dismissal should be granted and you are entitled to monetary relief, movement, in 61% of the cases. That's a great statistic if you were advising a client about whether or not to file a TCPA motion. You can say, well, look, even if the trial court denies it on appeal, we've got a really good chance of winning. 61%, those are great odds. And they were losing only 26% of the time, with some percentage, 13% in the what I call not applicable category. It's an opinion that either is dismissed for want of jurisdiction or something else. But you've got 61% winning, 26% losing. Then you get to 2019. By the end of 2019, and we've talked about all the things that happened in the interim, that flips Now move-ins are winning only 25% of the time, from 61% to 25%, and they're losing 57% of the time. So it's a complete reversal. And in 2020, those statistics continue. Move-ins this year are winning only 23% of the time. So it's gone down 25% in 2019, now only 23%. As practitioners, we are called upon to advise our clients about what is worth their time, their money. When a client has an adverse legal action filed against it and says, how can we get rid of this? Can we move to dismiss? And you're thinking about the TCPA, you're thinking about summary judgment, you're thinking about Rule 91A, which was also amended in 2019. And you have to tell your client, what are the best chances of success? What will be the most expensive? Practitioners have to understand that while there might still be reasons to utilize the TCPA in any given case over Rule 91A or a motion for summary judgment, the landscape is very different. It's a hard place to be in for those of us who filed motions prior to the shift and they still haven't been decided. And now we have a different type of jurisprudence. So there's some client counseling involved about what's happened. And I hope this program and the CLE will help clients, help lawyers advise their clients in explaining what happened. But now you've got ethical duties to be on top of this law and telling your client what their next best steps are. So I mentioned Rule 91A because the important change there is that it's no longer a mandatory attorney's fee loser pays provision. Attorney's fees under Rule 91A are now discretionary, which makes that motion much more attractive to a practitioner, to a client. I anticipate, I think most of us who practice in this area do, that parties will start utilizing Rule 91A more so than the TCPA because the courts are pulling back on the TCPA while at the same time the door has been opened. That's the trend that I am looking to see if it comes true. But the TCPA still offers the benefits, if you want to consider them that, of a stay of discovery, an automatic stay on appeal, and the immediate right to an interlocutory appeal. So the TCPA is not going away, but your balance is a little bit different now.
They also have changed the sanctions and fees provisions of the TCPA a little bit too, which may be a disincentive to some that they, you know, would have had earlier when you had mandatory sanctions, mandatory fees, and all that.
That's the point I was coming to was, you know, the two big hammers in this statute, aside from dismissal, were, you know, the idea of mandatory sanctions and then also in the prior version, mandatory attorney's fees. And you think about how that affects people appealing a dismissal order. The sanctions being there are not, this may be kind of neutral, but the idea of a progressive attorney fee, you know, prospective appellate attorney's fee being proved up and having to spend, or at least tacking on another, Amanda and I will agree on this, at least $20,000, if not more. And I know Jody agrees with that too, just for the chance to find out if you're right and if the other side in the court was wrong. And so having that be discretionary is a really nice change. But, you know, the idea of having to base, I mean, coming back to the statistics, if you can show the client, hey, you know, just at least statistically, your chances of actually getting relief went have gone and completely flipped in the last couple of years, maybe you can justify, you know, rolling the dice on being exposed to that conditional appellate fee. It's a little easier to it's a little more palatable. Whereas before, with the rates, the reversal rates so low, it was like, if you want to throw good money after bad, that's up to you as the client.
Right. Right. And it also gives non-movements, which remember, that can be a plaintiff or it can be a defendant with a counterclaim, but it gives anybody asserting the legal claim more leverage. Maybe that's settlement leverage, or we all know any number of things that can happen, but to be armed with the truth about what is happening on appeal in TCPA cases is just powerful for both sides.
Well, and in light of the GeoMet decision that came out from the Supreme Court last year, I mean, it really is hard. Once a TCPA case goes up on appeal, nothing can happen in the trial court. And all you can do is go to the Court of Appeals and hope that they'll help you out. If something comes up in the interim, whatever it is, whether it's a need for injunctive relief, you know, some kind, I mean, you now have to go directly to the Court of Appeals and ask them to do maybe some fact finding, which they're not going to want to do. And that creates a whole other layer of complication. that you need to think about, no matter which side you're on, really.
Absolutely right. The Supreme Court this year has issued another case that I think will continue to change the procedural practice, which is the In Re Panchakarla, if I'm saying that correctly, Panchakarla case. The Texas Supreme Court has now held that a trial court has the ability to reconsider a prior TCPA order, either granting or denying. Typically, it will be a grant because if it's a denial, there usually is an intermediate interlocutory appeal right away. But now think about what that means. If the trial court granted a TCPA motion and dismissed two of the four claims early in the litigation, the lawyer can come back 9 months, a year later, and ask the court to reconsider that ruling and potentially deny the TCPA motion. And that, to me, is a very interesting change procedurally.
It becomes more like a summary judgment practice.
Yeah, it just brings the TCPA orders in line with any other interlocutory order.
Correct. And I think that that underlies the court's ruling. Also, the 2019 amendments made a number of changes to the TCPA to align it with summary judgment practice in terms of the evidentiary requirements, the deadlines. There's a lot of things about the TCPA that now mirror summary judgment practice. And in fact, the statute references Rule 166A specifically. And so the case law that we've had for decades about summary judgment practice in terms of the notice of hearing deadline, the response deadline, and the evidentiary considerations are all now incorporated by reference into the TCPA practice.
It's nice to have those certainties ironed out because, you know, in the early days of the statute, there were so many uncertainties and, of course, no cases telling us how to read this. And cases where basically the courts have held, the trial court lost jurisdiction to change its order, you know, under the statute, even though it was an interlocutory order, were tough. And it's nice that the Supreme Court has kind of brought TCPA in line with other interlocutory orders there.
Right. The big procedural trap under the TCPA is still the hearing and ruling deadline. There were three cases out of Dallas recently, split opinions, all three, on what happens when the trial court begins to conduct a TCPA hearing, and then there's some discussion on the record, sometimes off the record, something happens, the hearing's continued, all the parties come back later, and a ruling is made. Is that ruling timely? Is it not timely? The Dallas court, like I said, has issued three opinions that are completely split in the outcomes, and they're covered in my paper. I won't bore you with more details, but there are definitely still traps for the unwary under the TCPA.
So, I mean, we've covered the recent amendments, I think, but considering how plugged into this statute you are there any other trends that you can identify or things that we should be on the lookout as far as the statute's future are concerned? Do you think, for example, that the legislature is going to be back in this again in the next session, tweaking it some more? Because it really resisted before.
It did. There was a lot of push from practitioners and industry groups in 2017 to make amendments, and the legislature didn't. Those bills never made it out of committee. Finally, there was momentum in 2019. I would like to see the legislature come back and correct a few things. There are even some errors, I believe, typographical errors, weird things in the 2019 amendments that need correcting. But given the number of important issues that the legislature is going to have on its plate in the next session, I'm not going to hold my breath to think that they're going to come back and make TCPA amendments the next time around. So I think they're probably going to give this new version a few years on the books to see what happens, to see if practitioners do shy away and turn to Rule 91A instead, and determine how necessary amendments might be. But if anybody in the legislature is listening, I would like to make some corrections if you want to email me.
Well, if you know them off the top of your head, this is a good forum to get that out there.
Well, I'll say the weirdest thing under the 2019 amendment is section 27.007, which requires findings of fact if the court makes a certain monetary award, but I believe that they referred to the wrong section number when describing what that monetary award is. And so the way the statute is written, it says that if the court makes a sanctions award in favor of the non-movement, then the court has to find whether or not the legal action was brought for an improper purpose. That's backwards in so many ways, because a non-movement wouldn't need a finding that its legal action was improper. It would want the opposite finding. And there is no award of sanctions to a non-movement under the TCPA. There is only award of cost and fees. So I think they just referred to the wrong section number, and it needs to be corrected to say that if the court awards sanctions to a prevailing movement, as opposed to awards fees and costs to a non-movement. But my hope is that trial courts and then courts of appeals will simply find it would be an absurd result to read it as written. But, you know, we live in a state that we adhere to the plain text, and there's a lot of value in doing that in many cases. So I don't know what the courts are going to do. I also wish the legislature would have clarified the effective date of the statute, because it just says to an action filed on or after September 1. And we don't know, is an action a legal action? Is an action a lawsuit? Is an action something different?
Mm-hmm.
I think that we are about to see a whole crop of opinions dealing with what the effective date means. And so if the legislature amends the statute in the future, I would hope they'd be more clear.
Well, I hope that someone is listening that will consider that, tack those on to anything that might be afoot as far as future amendments. I think we thought too that we might, I'll just use my favorite phrase in the world, I think we thought we might pick your brain on some substantive issues. I think Jody maybe had some. He was interested. I know that I have a couple. We won't spend a long time talking about this. I'll throw one out there. I've got two. And the first one that I have found interesting in my dealings with this statute, this is like stump the TCPA expert, Jody.
Do I need to clear conflicts first?
I don't think so. I've seen a few opinions on sanctions that basically have said, well, there's really no need for deterrence here. This was kind of a one-time thing. And so I'm going to award either, you know, a dollar nominal sanctions or zero. Have you seen any, is there a trend defined on that? Or is that just, it's going to be, you know, make your best argument if you're the party being sanctioned, or this is completely against the statute? Or what are you thinking about that based on what you've seen?
I think we've had about 8 opinions that hold you can do a nominal award. There's one opinion that actually says a $0 award isn't reversible error unless you prove harm. And just the same standard as always, you have to prove harm to get a reversal. I think it's totally fine to give the trial judge discretion, even under a mandatory sanction statute. If the trial judge has seen, heard, smelled the evidence, and that's their job, and they don't believe that any further sanction is necessary to deter a party from filing a similar legal action, that awarding a $1 nominal sanction is just fine. Of course, now under the new statute, they have full discretion to not award any sanctions. And so that issue has been resolved. But under the old text, I really just think that's the trial judge's determination, and it's reviewed for abuse of discretion. And as the movement, if you want sanctions, this is true under the old or new statute, you really have an evidentiary burden to put forward some evidence to explain to the trial court what is going on in this case. Why are sanctions actually needed to prevent further slap actions from being filed by that particular party? And in some cases, there has been robust evidence about why you need to sanction a party to prevent further slap actions. And you can look at those opinions for ideas on what type of evidence to put forward in the trial court. But the movements have to remember they have an evidentiary burden. It's not just a give me.
Right. Jody, do you have one you want to throw out?
The thing that I've always thought was interesting is 27011 about construction, how it, you know, says, well, this doesn't abrogate or lessen any other defense or remedy or any of that kind of stuff. But I haven't really seen courts use that as a way around the statute. Have there been opinions where courts have said, oh, you know, there is kind of a conflict here and we're going to go with this other statute? I know for a while, non-compete preemption was kind of the hot topic on that subject, but I haven't really been following it in the last year or so on what's gone on. Have there been any findings or rulings on that issue?
No, not really. There are very few cases that even cite that provision. And I think it's a very interesting question about whether sovereign immunity would prevent a monetary award against a governmental party when the governmental party is the non-movement, meaning the party that brought the claim, and a private party says, the government's claim against me should be dismissed and I should get fees and sanctions against the government. Does sovereign immunity prevent that kind of award? That has not been answered, because I think it's a rare circumstance that you have a party seeking to dismiss a claim by a government, but it has happened in cases I've been involved in, and there is no answer on the sovereign immunity question.
Well, the second thing that I wanted to bring up was the whole idea of supersedious of a TCPA order. The trap 24 says, in an ordinary context, you have to put up the amount, the actual damages, interest, and what am I missing?
Cost.
Yeah, cost. Okay. Usually that phrase is so stuck in my head, I can just rattle it off. Here under, you know, the pressure of recording, I guess I just had a freeze. But I mean, I haven't seen any cases on this specific to the TCPA that I can remember. But, you know, it seems like there's some room to argue if you're the non-movement and you're the recipient of a bad order that says, you know, $100,000 in sanctions and $100,000 in attorney's fees, that you might get a free pass on superseding that order under the traditional methods like bond or a cash deposit. They don't fall within the 24.2 context.
Right. I agree with you that the Texas Supreme Court has been abundantly clear that a judgment debtor is not required to post supersedious bond or deposit to cover the amount of attorney's fees or sanctions. Those are not compensatory damages. Sanctions, of course, are punitive in nature. And there's nothing under the TCPA that would make the award of monetary of attorney's fees any different than any other statutory award of attorney's fees that is not an award of damages. I mean, there is a carve out for a narrow type of case. For example, I think in Ray Nally Plastics, the example the Supreme Court talked about was a claim by an attorney going after a client for a failure to pay a prior fee bill. And when you're being awarded fees, in air quotes, those are really damages. That's not true with a fee award under the TCPA. That is just a statutory fee shifting provision. And I don't think that judgment debtors, non-movements who've been hit with a fee award are required to bond around it.
So it seems like there's still an open question about how, if you need to do something to actually supersede a TCPA order while you're taking your interlocutory appeal. And I think there's some gray area in there that may need to be developed through some further case law, but I'm not anxious to be the one to develop that law.
Well, Todd, I love that we're talking about this because, you know, early in my career, before I started speaking about the TCPA, you and I had a great little paper on supersedious practice, and it was fun to go around and give that presentation with you. So maybe we'll just pair back up on this.
Well, it's time that we update that paper, but I don't know when you're going to have time.
Oh, all kinds of spare time.
All right. We're coming to the end of the time that we generally have allotted for conversations with our guests, but we want to say thank you, Amanda, for being with us. It's been super informative, and I always learn something about the TCPA and many other topics when you and I get the chance to visit.
Absolutely.
We're glad to wrap it up, Amanda. So we've kind of got our little script that we follow. So just bear with us as we go through that. But was there anything that we didn't cover that you wanted to talk about?
I think we got it.
Good deal. Okay. So I'll start closing us out here. Before we go, we'd like to pause for a moment and thank our sponsors, Thompson Reuters and Court Surety Bond Agency. We appreciate their support. And thanks for listening to this episode. If you're enjoying the podcast, please recommend it to colleagues you think might benefit from listening.
Taking the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts would be great too. We appreciate everyone who's rated us so far.
And if you have questions, thoughts, or comments, please shoot us an email at hosts@texapplawpod.com. Message us on Twitter or Instagram at TexAppLawPod, or reach out through the podcast Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you.
Until next time, we wish you all the best and hope you're all staying safe and healthy.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. To stay in touch with your hosts, suggest topics, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at TexAppLawPod.com. or on Twitter at TexAppLawPod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.